Thanks for joining. Welcome to Behind the Vinyl.
No problem.
Congratulations on your most recent record, Dopamine.
Thank you very much.
So, killer record. We're going to dig a little bit into that and dig into a few other things. I just want to start by the Western Sky. That's a killer heavy opening to an album. It was great.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, we're involved in this charity sort of fundraising bike ride pretty much every year for the last sort of 10 years. It didn't happen obviously during lockdown and COVID and everything, but it's a weird mixture of people. It's ourselves, people from the military, people from the financial institutions, and it's normally about 30 people, and we all ride through various of the more obscure parts of Canada and the US. So all the kind of Rocky Mountain states, and it lost about 12 days, and people sponsor us to do it, and it raises money for a charity called Childline.
Okay.
And it's great. We managed to raise about $250,000 so far. So basically that song is was kind of inspired by that trip, really. And I'd always fancy kind of trying to write a motorbike anthem, even though I'm not a biker myself, I have to be honest.
but you did do the ride this time.
Yeah, but I do it in a pickup truck.
Oh, touché.
Which is useful for all the pillion riders when it starts raining. They don't want to get pillion.
Well, doing a thing like that, I mean, you must see a lot of really cool stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, you see the kind of parts of America that you don't see if you're over there as a musician, you know. You find yourself going through these kind of literally one horse towns where there's like one bar and the guy in the bar running the bar's got one tooth and it could be his sister, it could be his wife is working there, so it's always difficult to tell. Could be both, who knows. So it's kind of, yeah, it's a little bit of that going on. But what's always amazing to me is how, you know, friendly all the locals are and how interested they are in, you know, in where you're from and what you're doing and stuff. And it's, we've only ever had like a really, really kind of great welcome wherever we've been, really. It's been great. And there's some of the geography that it's absolutely eye-watering. Places like Montana and Utah, off the beaten track, but Christ, they're worth going to see because the scale of everything is just enormous and quite moving sometimes. It's pretty something.
Yeah, it is. Cool.
That's really cool. And so this song, you wrote that after it? Did it directly influence this song, that trip?
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole thing about the things you see, you know, the extremes. In any one day, you can see kind of mountains, you can see ocean, you can see huge lakes, you know, and such is the geography of the country. And, yeah, so that was kind of the thinking behind the lyric, really. It's just trying to sort of capture that a little bit, maybe.
Long way from that one horse town.
I remember telling, because I talked to Danny a few weeks back, and I told him that my favorite song on the album is Big Pink Supermoon, and he sounded kind of surprised.
Well, it's interesting because we've had quite a lot of people pick up on that track. I think probably because it's there were two reasons. I think one, because it's sort of unlike anything we've done before, and it's quite jazzy for us. It has a 2.5 minute sax solo in it, which I never thought you'd ever see on a Thunder record, but it kind of evolved naturally into that. And it's an interesting track. It's I've always been into sort of to me, it's kind of like Tom Petty meets Van Morrison meets a few other kind of things, really. And it's just it's a nice groove, and it's nice to kind of sometimes play in a kind of more kind of restrained mode, particularly as we get older. Yeah. And it's cool, it's cool to get other musicians in sometimes as well. It just kind of gives things a little kind of spice up, and it's interesting for us as musicians. I mean, we're not the kind of band that just want to keep making the same record over and over. That's not what we do. For us, it's still kind of about where we can go, how much we can explore, and keeping ourselves interested musically, really.
Yeah.
So adding to that, you are always constantly pushing yourself, in new directions and new boundaries and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think it's nice to kind of, I guess after the amount of time we've been together and the amount of records we've made, we're very fortunate in that we have a very kind of dedicated and loyal fan base who kind of will go with us into the kind of our kind of odd musical kind of direction sometimes. I mean, when we made the album Please Remain Seated, which was a very gentle affair for us, kind of a kind of re-examination of the old songs. I don't want to call it just an acoustic album, so it was a bit kind of more than that. But and we thought we were kind of slightly nervous about how that would be received by our fans, but they loved it. So, and that tour was actually very satisfying. To do a tour sitting down, playing kind of gently for an hour and a half was quite something. Once again, we were nervous about that, but it came across, it worked very well. So I think that kind of bought us a lot of wiggle room maybe going forwards in terms of what we do. And I think that's kind of a nice thing, because the last thing you want to do is kind of go stale musically. It's important to sort of, try new things and sometimes they're not going to work, but you've got to try. As a person who writes the songs, I mean, I would hate to kind of be working to a formula. I couldn't do it. And I don't think the band could do it either, to be fair.
Yeah.
Well, how do you look at your, and Danny's musical relationship? When I was talking to him, he was praising you.
Mm-hmm. I think he's shit. No, not really. obviously we go back a long way. And as a person who writes the band songs, it's fantastic for me, just individually, as a songwriter, to have somebody who can sing that way, because, he is capable of singing anything. And that's great. When you don't have any kind of those kind of considerations when you're writing, it makes your life a lot easier. But it's also like because we met when we were 11 years old, we literally grew up together. So we have so much kind of common experience of life, music, everything really. And I think that is that's obviously the key kind of pivot of the band, really, is my relationship with him. And fortunately for us, we're still very good friends and we still get along great and still make each other laugh. And, Harry and Benny I've known nearly as long. I mean, I met them when I was sort of 18, 19. So, the core of the band is very, very solid. We're friends first, band second. I think that's also really worth pointing out. I think if any of us didn't really want to keep doing it, then we'd stop. I think it would be very difficult to sort of carry on, because of that, the balance of the people in it is crucial to everything.
supposed to do? Well, I tried screaming, but there's no
Has that ever been something recently? Because the climate of music has changed definitely since you guys have been a band. Is that something, I'm saying recently, yeah, recently, like in the last 10 years or something, have you ever seriously considered of stepping away from Thunder as a band?
To be honest with you, I think in the, you know, over the years we've been together, we've stopped twice. We've stopped on two occasions. On both occasions, we've all done different things, and I think that's been good for us in that we've all brought something back when we got back together. And I think, you know, your any different experiences you have are always going to enhance what you do, hopefully. And I think, you know, now having sort of learned that, I think for me personally, anyway, it's, I always, every couple of years now, I try and look for something, a little project to do, something to work on, whether it's producing or writing with somebody or you know, even doing a few gigs with somebody else. It's all good to do once in a while because I think it keeps you refreshed and, you know, and like I said, every time I feel like every time I do that, I bring something back. You know, you always learn when you do something new. And so, yes, I think it's important to do it. And I think Thunder allows us all the scope to do that, and that's really important. You know, I think it's different when you're kind of 60 to when you're 30. You know, life is more to it. There's more kind of things to think about, family, and you know, these are all important things. And so I think, you know, there has to be a kind of balance in between, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but your work-life relationship has to be right. And, you know, I think we do strive to kind of make sure that we do kind of look after that. It's important, you know.
Well, I mean, when you guys came out late 80s, bands, musicians were, you know, you were still selling physical albums. I mean, how do you look at that compared to today? I mean, do you miss those days where you actually had a physical album in your hand?
Well, interestingly enough, one of the reasons we're very fortunate is that we still sell quite a lot of physical product, CDs and vinyl. And I think that's probably because most of our fans, like us, are quite old. They like the physical item. They like to collect. They like to feel things. They like to open up big books and look at them. And so, you know, that's a great thing. And that allows us the kind of, I suppose, the luxury in today's market of being able to kind of get into the design of the sleeve and the artwork and all that stuff. And because that's really important. It's massively important. And like, you know, because that's kind of what we grew up with. And I think if, you know, I mean, try and imagine Dark Side of the Moon without the artwork. I mean, it's not kind of going to work, is it? And I think for us, that aspect of it is extremely important. So, you know, we are lucky that there's been a bit of a resurgence in vinyl as well. And that's really cool. So it means we can work in sort of 12 inch squares first and then bring that down to CD size and what have you. And, you know, because you know, we like to get kind of very involved in that, and I think, you can't stop change. Change is what it is, and I think, you know, if people listen to our album via Spotify, or you know, or they download it, most people don't know this streaming platforms or YouTube these days. And it's great. I mean, it's, you know, the only thing I think Spotify is a fantastic thing. I mean, to be able to kind of on your phone just find any piece of music ever made virtually is a fantastic thing. I just wish they'd fucking pay us properly. That's a whole other conversation.
Absolutely. I'd also go as far as to say I'm actually pretty comfortable with the way like rock music and heavy rock music is these days. I kind of feel it's possibly the healthiest it's been in 20 years, you know, like, and and maybe stable. You know, it's stable. You've got bands like Whitesnake in Europe were just out playing in the UK to sold out shows. You know, you guys are out playing festivals shortly. Maiden's out. It may not be peaking, but it's steady and healthy.
Well, I think rock music is like it's interesting because I think when it's pushed out into the mainstream, which occurs every 20 years or something, something will come along where that kind of forces it forward. The last time was grunge. I mean, in the 80s, you had bands like Bon Jovi, Guns N' Roses crossing over. Yeah. And occasionally kind of rears its head in the mainstream. But I think rock flourishes when it's slightly underground. I think when it's something that young people can go and discover. I mean, certainly for me, when I was a kid, you know, I used to watch Top of the Pops every week, but you never saw Led Zeppelin on Top of the Pops. And kind of finding out about Led Zeppelin was over this kind of enigmatic band that never did interviews with this fantastic music and really kind of provocative album sleeves. There was this kind of mystique about them, which was part of the magic. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So when they came to town to play, everybody wanted to go. And I think these days, you know, because Rocket has drifted away from the mainstream again quite heavily, I think that's good for it in that it's now again become a kind of cultish music that perspective, not for people our age, but for kids. Yeah. Kids now go find rock music and it feels kind of secret and special. And, you know, and certainly that's my experience from talking to young people that come see us. I think that's cool. I think when people go looking for something or are interested in it, it extends its shelf life massively rather than kind of being a disposable thing that's kind of rammed down your throat like most pop music is. So, yeah, I think it's good. You know, I think it is healthy. I think people will always pick up guitars as long as there's guitars around. And, you know, and rock as a kind of musical genre, loosely speaking, is still the most exciting thing to see live. You know, it's human. It's real. You can't fake it. You can either play or you can't. It's, you know, there's nowhere to hide. And I think audiences respond to that. And it still blows my brains out when I meet young people and they go, you know, they come up to see us and they go, oh, that was my first ever gig. And they're like 28. And you go, what have you been, you know? But it doesn't matter. I think I agree. I think it is healthy. I mean, you know, on this tour we're doing in the UK right now, we have, we've got Ugly Kid Joe as special guests, but opening every night, we've got like a different British band from whichever area we're playing in. And we had Massive Wagons the other night in Leeds, who are very good. We've got Chris Barras opening for us in London. So we have all these kind of up-and-coming British acts, and it's kind of nice to be able to do that, to give them a little sort of, you know, shot of playing in a big venue and stuff. So, you know, certainly there seems to be no shortage of young bands trying to do something here. But I think the big problem for young kids now, though, is that the, you know, when we first started, when we signed to EMI, it was possible to sign to a label and, you know, and they would invest money. They would stick you on the road. Even if you were losing money hand over fist, they'd keep you on the road and get you playing in front of people, give you an opportunity to build up a fan base. And that doesn't exist anymore. So it's very difficult now for bands to get from, you know, the first kind of step on the ladder and create some kind of profile, because there's so much online, you know, there's so much competition in that area that the big thing I think with rock music is still playing in front of people. But to get yourself into a position where you're competing for those gigs is difficult. So yeah, I have every sympathy for young kids now, I really do.
Was your moment at the top in the light? Nobody tells you that's the brightest you'll ever shine. Still, you keep on bloody minded, praying kind of dice will fall. Driven on by desperation, tired of feeling small. Till you hear last daughter's call. I'm appreciated. They couldn't see what you had. Most, they couldn't touch you. But they had luck on their side. You never reached that dizzy summit. You never got beyond the wall. Somewhere inside you still believe it. You'll make it to the ball before you hear last orders call.
Speaking of gigs and speaking of, Darren mentioned Whitesnake. I mean, you guys played Donington in 1919, and you were a fairly new band then, and yeah. You had Poison and Aerosmith as well. I mean, what do you remember from that? Did you hang out with Bret Michaels and the guys?
To be honest with you, it was we were on stage for I think 40 minutes. It was the quickest 40 minutes of my life. It was a blur because I think we were very nervous before. It was the first really big gig we ever did. It's really funny. I've never, ever been nervous since that day on stage, ever. That cured me of all nerves. 80,000 people in broad daylight, that's a real test. But I think because we went down well, you know, it changed our career, that one gig. And that's how, you know, powerful it was. I mean, in terms of hanging out with other people, obviously, you know, we're quite friendly with David Coverdale and obviously, the Choir Boys were on the bill that day as well, and Spike is a really good friend of mine. Poison, we didn't really kind of get to sort of hang out with them, or, you know, Aerosmith we played with before that. We did some shows with them in 1989. And, you know, yeah, I mean, it's the thing with festivals. It's the nice thing about it is you get to see people and you do get to kind of have a quick chat with people who, you know, you don't normally see because you're usually both working. And so that aspect of it, I've always enjoyed. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to a few festival gigs this summer and doing a bit more of that.
But nice. Sticking with that show in particular, that must have been hallowed ground for you, you know, being Donington. You must have visited there a few times yourself, you know, out in the paddock with the common people.
Funny enough, I'd never been to Donington as it was, Monsters of Rock as it was then. I had been to other festivals though. I'd been to Reading several times when it was less of an indie festival and more of a kind of sort of multi-genre festival. I'd been to Nebworth a few times. Right. I saw Zeppelin Nebworth, I see Deep Purple at Nebworth. I'd been to other festivals, but I'd never been up to Donington. So it was the first time. But the day that we arrived for soundcheck, which was on a Friday, the day before, was the first time I'd ever been to the site. I've been a few times since, obviously. We've played there quite a bit now over the years. But I've never been up there. Like, so I'm obviously from the south of England and never kind of as a young kid, never travelled that far. But and also it started, I think maybe, when was the first year? Was it 1980?
Yeah.
Yeah, was it 80 or was it 79 already? Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And it was the first, wasn't it? It was the first single sort of genre festival. It was the first one. It's like, we're going to take all bands, all rock bands. And since then, that's been the model for festivals ever since, pretty much. It's like, this day we're going to have this kind of band, this day we're going to have that kind of band. And I'm not sure about that as a thing. I mean, for me, like I said, in 1975, I went to Reading Festival and with Danny, actually, and another friend from school. And over 3 days, we saw bands as diverse as Judas Priest, Joan Armatrading, Yes, Dr. Feelgood, Supertramp, Judas Priest, UFO, Thin Lizzy, Christ, the Mahavishnu Orchestra. It was so all over the shop, but it was brilliant because it was never boring.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's like if you sit through 3 days of just rock bands, I just want to blow my brains out. Right? All striking the same pose. It's like, fuck off, enough already. For me, I listen to lots of different kinds of music. So the idea of going to a festival where there's lots of kind of music appeals to me much more than just one genre, despite the fact we play a lot of single, rock festivals, but that's because we have to, that's how it is.
Yep.
But, most people have a record collection that's fairly varied, I think. So, and yet we all go to gigs, to watch gigs, where there's only one kind of band. I always find that a bit odd, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, also you've name dropped Led Zeppelin twice, and that basically sums up their musical catalogue, because that's the supposed greatest heavy metal band of all time is far from heavy metal. You can't Led Zeppelin 1 to Houses of the Holy. It's it's the complete different direction. So
I think the thing that normally defines heavy metal, I suppose, is the guitar sound. To be perfect, it's that big, fat, dirty guitar sound. And it's not a sound that Zeppelin ever employed, really. I mean, here and there, but very rarely. But a lot of Jimmy's sounds are very clean. But a big, powerful drummer, big, powerful drum sound. And obviously a high tenor for a vocalist. And they're the kind of other constituent parts of rock and roll, if you like. I never thought Zeppelin as being that heavy. I thought they were fucking very powerful, very dynamic, but never really that heavy in the same way that Sabbath were very heavy. That kind of... that guitar sound as thick as mud with Sabbath, and it's brilliant. But to me, it's a completely different thing. It's all rock, it's all part of it. I mean, I remember the first time I heard Soundgarden thinking, and this is like, I was in America the first time I heard them, and everybody was talking about grunge. And, what is grunge? And then I heard Soundgarden, and I thought, it just sounds like Sabbath. How is this new and exciting? I mean, it's great, but it's not really reinventing the wheel. It's just like a geezer in a different, in a plaid shirt, with a few tattoos and a pair of shorts on, but it still fucking sounds like Sabbath at the end of the day. And it's great. I love Soundgarden, but you know what I mean? I forgot what the question was now. I've gone off on a mad tangent. But, Led Zeppelin. I mean, Led Zeppelin, for me, the width of their catalogue is, what I think separates them from a lot of other rock bands. I think it's... they weren't afraid of trading. And I think Queen, you could say the same about Queen. But you could say the same about the Beatles, So, I mean, it's all rock and roll at the end of the day. I mean, like I said, the things get put in boxes, sometimes I think for the convenience of people, no disrespect, but people writing and broadcasting about it, it's easier to kind of reference things that way. I think all the bands that I really like, really, really like a lot, have kind of quite a varied portfolio of influences. And I think that's good to have. I can't
can't sleep, it's 4 a.m. The walls are closing in once more. Cold house, soulless rooms, no trace of you here anymore. But I'll never give up, and I'll never give in, even though it's a fact I'm losing it. No, I'll never give up, even though I'm unraveling. Where's the man I used to be? The hopes and dreams we used to share. Everything I ever was only
of Led Zeppelin. I mean, Led Zeppelin were known for the debauchery in the 70s and the partying and everything like that. I mean, did Thunder ever go through any like heavy partying? Did you ever have like a time of debauchery?
We did. it didn't last very long because we obviously, when Thunder broke through, we weren't 21, we were sort of 29, 30. And we'd been in bands that had failed dismally before that. So when Thunder actually did well, we did kind of roll up our sleeves the first 2 years and say, right, you're going to fucking enjoy this. And we did. But we were never a drug band. I mean, all of us like a drink. Thankfully, none of us had a problem with it, but we're all able to enjoy it without it becoming an issue, which isn't always the case with musicians. But we did. I mean, we had a wild old time, you know. It was just drinking girls, really. That was it. And then we kind of, you suddenly, there's a realisation one day, you know, when you go one hangover too far and you think, you know what? Or you get on stage one night and it feels a bit difficult. You think, like, need to rein it in a little bit. Now, you know, people pay a lot of money to go to gigs. And you want to be able to give of your best, you know. And I think if you're like I said, when you're 20, 21, or you know, you can kind of shake it off and you're fine. You know, you can't when you get in your 40s and 50s. It's a different ball game. But you still want to be as good. So that, you know, that means a compromise, which is less booze, more sleep, all of those things.
We want to kind of dig into a couple of tracks specifically on the record. Firstly, I just want to ask two quick questions. You were out with Black Star Riders too recently, right?
Yeah, I was
a couple of years ago.
I've known Ricky obviously many years, 30 odd years, because the Almighty started around about the same time as Thunder. And I know Scott very well because we played golf together occasionally. So one of their guitar players, Damien, couldn't do a few shows. They had a few shows, festival shows in South America. And they called up and asked if I was around to do it. And fortunately, it coincided with the time where Thunder weren't doing much. So it was like, yeah, brilliant, fantastic. So we did, I think, six shows in South America with Judas Priest and some with Alice in Chains as well. But it wasn't exactly a punishing schedule. It was something like six shows in maybe 14 days. So there was a lot of time to sit around in Rio and drink caipirinhas and look at the beach. And so it was a lovely tour. And it was great as well to, I was saying earlier, you don't get a chance to catch up with people you know. But it was great. So I spent a lot of time hanging out with Ricky and Scott, you know, putting the world to rights and, you know, telling more stories like you do. And so it was a very pleasant experience.
Very cool.
Nice.
And the other question is, that's a new tattoo on your arm there?
It's not that old, actually. I think I got this for my... This is about 5 years old. I've never had tattoo. I just fancy... For my 56th birthday, I treated myself.
All right. we obviously just lost Taylor Hawkins, and that looks quite similar to the one that he had on his arm. So I was just wondering if there was any connection.
It's an eagle on my wrist. There you go. Yeah.
Cool. Let's dig into the record a little bit. When did you start writing this record? And it's a long record too. There's 16 tracks on this record, right?
Yeah. We recorded 20 and whittled it down to 16. And we didn't intend for it to be that many, but we just felt that the 16 that we kind of arrived at all had to be heard. So that was it, really. Once the decision was made, it was going to be a double album. I started writing it pretty much straight after the... as soon as lockdown started, really, I was starting sort of gathering ideas. And it was written quite quickly, though. I mean, I think the bulk of the songs were probably written in a period of sort of 4 months. Because, you know, it's a great thing about... I mean, lockdown for lots of people was dreadful and everything. But for me, actually, it was quite a positive thing because I didn't have anything else to think about at all. My wife works in the film business and she wasn't working either. So, it gave us quite a lot of time to hang out together and listen to music and drink too much wine and eat food and just basically have almost like a kind of holiday. But I was working really hard all the way through it and I just kept writing every day. And it's really good to do that because you don't usually get the opportunity to concentrate your time that much. So I decided I would do that and sort of try and take advantage of it as much as possible, really. Yeah, so it's probably about 4 months in June.
We'll be right back.
Where did the album title come from? Dopamine.
Well, interestingly enough, I just kind of happened to notice this article in a British newspaper. It was an interview with an American psychologist, and she was saying that we've all become dopamine addicts via our use of mobile phones and all the social networking apps, you know, wanting to get likes on every photograph we put up, and our phones have kind of become our shrink and our doctor, and our, you know, everything is in this little fucking device in your hand. And I started thinking about that, and I just thought dopamine was a kind of cool sounding word, and I thought, well, I sort of made a note of it, or maybe there's a song in that or something. And then in the end, I didn't use it for a song, but then we were sort of trying to think of a good album title. And obviously the album deals a lot with pandemic, you know, the world we live in today sort of thing, and how difficult how people suffer isolation. And this is partly as a result of everybody living on their phones and not socialising properly anymore and all that. And that sort of referred me back to the dopamine thing. So I said, well, what about dopamine as the title? And, yeah, the band thought it was cool. So that was it, really. We were off. Yeah.
Cool.
Very cool. How do you like? We're all a little bit older here. How do you when you get a riff in mind or something? Do you how do you work that? Are you one of these people that you pick up your phone straight away and put it on record and you record it, or is it something?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, my phone is full of me, you know, playing little riffs or singing the odd melody or whatever. It's just little things, or even talking to it, you know, if I get an idea for a lyric or something. Yeah, I mean, it's my notebook now. But I'm fortunate enough to have a little studio in my house, so I can sort of record, you know, quite kind of, you know, convincing, you know, sounding demos. And that's kind of our, basically how my writing patterns evolved really over the last 20 years. I bought my first home studio 20 odd years ago. Yeah. When it was a fucking huge thing. I thought I'd never get it in the house. And now, of course, it's just a laptop on a little box, right? It's just crazy. But that's enabled me to obviously experiment and spend time doing stuff, which you wouldn't have the time or the inclination necessarily to do in a big studio and the whole band of it. And I think it's really helped, is to help me as a writer and a producer, because hopefully by the time we get into the studio, I might already made all the mistakes at home. And gone through all the kind of down the blind alley. So when we get into the studio, all we have to do is play and kind of relax, you know, and not work too hard. That's the theory anyway.
Have you ever done a Kirk Hammett where you lose your phone and you lose all your song ideas?
No, I dread that. I dread that. I back my phone up regularly for precisely that reason.
Did that too, right?
Was that?
I think you too did that. I think
really,
Bono left his the CD, you know, on a car when he was going somewhere, and they lost all the recordings. Yeah.
Oh my god! Yeah, back everything up twice. That's you have to. Yeah. You have to.
Wow.
Yes. So you said you wrote 20 songs. What do you do with those four remaining songs? You know, do you keep them and. Well, could they see the light of day on the next record or something like that? And is there an old track like that on this record? One that's maybe taken a few years, you know, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years to evolve into something that you're comfortable with?
Funnily enough, no. They're all kind of songs on the new album were all written, you know, like in the same period. So
okay. That
wasn't the case. With the four that we recorded that weren't released. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they'll see like that at some point. But one of the things we wanted to do with this album, because we record companies are very keen for you to have, you know, multi kind of packages for albums, you know, like what a single CD, a double CD with extra tracks, a vinyl, a double vinyl, a cassette, blah, blah, blah. And then you have things like the Japanese label want an exclusive track. And you go through all this, you know, you make an album, then everybody wants another four or five songs. So what we... In kind of knowing that we'd got a double album's worth of material, we just went to BMG and said, look, this is it. 16 songs, that's it. There is no more. Do what you like with it, but that is it. We're not going to suddenly produce another track out of a back pocket. And at first they were like, oh, okay. But then they got the idea, and then it was like, okay, well, no, that's cool, it's clean. And because, you know, if I was a fan and I rushed out and bought an album and 3 weeks later there was another version of the album with two extra songs on it, I'd be pissed off. Yep. And, you know, that had happened with our last album a little bit. And normally it's the sort of thing that we're very good at controlling when we have been over the years. We don't, we're very aware of you know, like I said earlier, how our people work for their money. And, you know, if people are kind of going to spend money on something of yours, or it's a gig or an album, you want them to make, you know, you want to feel like they're getting value. So, you know, I'm quite pleased that we managed to do that with this album. There's only one version of it. That's a lot. You can pick, you can have it on CD, you can have it on vinyl, you can have it on a download, you can just do it on Spotify. But there's just the 16 songs and that's it. With the extra, I think they may turn up. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, listen, with a band that's been going as long as us, there's always going to be somebody releasing a compilation album or a best of or a live at the whatever. So maybe those tracks will come in useful for that. I don't know. But I'm sure there's still a lot of bad stuff.
if there's one track that you're probably the most pleased with or satisfied with for whatever reason, what would it be on the record?
Oh God, it's a tough one.
Pick one of your kids and throw the rest to the curve.
I'd probably go with Big Pink Supermoon because I think it's unlike anything we've done before, and it shows a side of the band as musicians that probably most people. I mean, if you play, spend most of your life playing loud rock and roll, sometimes it's quite difficult to play quietly and gently. It's one of the things that a lot of rock musicians struggle with because they're so used to being loud and powerful and all those things. And, you know, if you say to someone like Harry, our drummer, he's fucking loud. He's very, very loud. You say, okay, try playing quietly. He looks very confused. And it takes a little while to kind of find that pocket. But when you do, it's kind of strangely liberating. We had to do that with that song. And also, I like the fact that we were brave enough to put a 2.5-minute sax solo on the end of it. I mean, we weren't intending to. It was going to be a guitar solo. It was going to fade at probably 4.5 minutes. And then, because it had this kind of nice feel to it, I suggested saxophone. They all looked at me like I was insane. But the studio we were working in, Rockfield, down in Wales, and our engineer, Nick, said, look, I know this great brass player. And this guy had helped us before, actually, on some sort of fairly sort of subliminal brass stuff. So I said, well, is he a good soloist? He said, I think so. I said, well, let's send him over the track because this is obviously during COVID, so we couldn't get him into the studio. He's also agoraphobic, so there's two reasons we couldn't get him to the studio. Yeah. But he's got a studio in his house. So we sent him the track. My only brief to him was Junior Walker and FM by Steely Dan. You know, there's a fantastic sax solo at the end of that. That was all I said to him. And literally 20 minutes later, he sent the track back and he'd done two passes out, so the two solos, both of which were absolutely fucking amazing. And it was really difficult. It took us longer to choose which one to use than it did for him to play it. But in the end, we went with the first one, and it was so good, right till the death of the fade, that we just couldn't bring ourselves to fade it. It's like, no, leave it. So that's how the song ended up being like 6.5 minutes or whatever. So that was kind of really exciting. Like I said, because it was different and for us and in a slightly different direction, there was a lot of joy in that track. And I'd go with that one.
Killer. Nice.
Thanks for your time. Really cool. Good talking to you.
Yeah, great.
Well, guys, nice to you too. Nice talking to you.
Absolutely. And we'll see you, I don't know, in about 2 weeks or so. I think you're over here in Sweden in 2 weeks.
That's right. Yeah, I look forward to that. Be good.
Yeah. Cool.
Nice.
Thank you.
Thank you, mate.
Bye. Best bye.